Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Tensions between the United States and Iran may be at their highest point since the takeover of the American embassy in Tehran in 1979 that included Americans being held hostage for 444 days. The Trump administration pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. Four oil tankers were attacked in the Straits or near the Straits of Hormuz in the last month, and Iran shot down an American drone aircraft last week, claiming it was in their airspace, while the administration says the drone was in international waters. The president imposed new economic sanctions on Iran's leadership this week, and Iran has responded with insults and more threats. Our guest today has studied and written about the current situation and joins us today, Dr. Christopher Bolin, a senior fellow in the Middle East program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, a professor of Middle East Security Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Dr. Bolin, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
If you have a question or a comment that you'd like to weigh in on relations between the United States and Iran, this is your opportunity. Give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Bolin, how would you provide an overall description of what's going on now between the United States and Iran?
Well, the situation's obviously incredibly tense, as you laid out in your introductory piece here. It's tough seeing a good way forward out of the crisis that we're into. I mean, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Iran are really hitting the Iranian economy incredibly hard. I mean, just to give you a sense for that, before the sanctions were reimposed, Iran, that's largely dependent on its oil exports, was exporting about 2.5 million barrels per day. Today, it's down to under 400,000 barrels a day, and the U.S. goal is to get it down to zero barrels a day. So government revenues have been reduced by some 70%. Inflation is running incredibly high at about 40%. The Iranian currency, the rial, has actually been devalued, and it's lost probably close to two-thirds of its value. So people's savings are just drying up, and it really eliminates their ability to withstand this kind of continued hardship. So food is up about 40 to 60%. Medicines are increasingly unavailable to average people. So it's hitting very, very hard.
Since 1979, the Iranian Revolution, we've often seen demonstrations, protests in Iran, where we heard the chant, "Death to America." I wonder, the Iranian people, who do they blame for the hardships they're going through? Do they blame their government? Do they blame the United States?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, the Iranian public is actually pretty sophisticated public. I mean, they're well-educated. They really pay attention to what's going on in the world. And a lot of those chants, of course, are, you know, it's government-inspired revolutionary fervor. In terms of what Iranian people actually believe, it's a little bit dicier because polling in authoritarian governments is a little bit problematic. And a lot of folks will point to the fact that despite these tensions that really have existed in the relationship between U.S. and Iran since 1979, so close to four decades now, that the Iranian public is actually one of the more pro-American publics in the region. That's particularly true for their support and appreciation of U.S. values and the democratic form of government. I mean, polls will routinely say that Iranians rate democracy. 90% of Iranians will rate democracy as a favorable or very favorable form of government. So they've got very positive attitudes towards American values and democracy, at least as an ideal form of government.
What about their own government?
Yeah, their own government, again, it's a little bit mixed picture, right? I mean, in terms of who they blame for the sanctions, too, that's a little bit more complicated. I mean, because they do pay attention to news, I think the latest polls show about a little under 60% actually put the primary blame for the economic problems they're confronting squarely at the doorstep of the government. It's corruption, it's economic mismanagement on the part of the government. But since the U.S. has reimposed sanctions, there's a stronger and stronger minority, about 40%, who increasingly blame the United States and foreign pressures for the economic hardships that they're facing right now. But in terms of support for their own form of government, I mean, interestingly enough, about 75% of the population, again, if you, you know, believe the polls, which are credible in my view, 75% are actually comfortable with the current form of government. So folks who are talking and hoping for regime change, I think if polls are accurate, that's going to ring pretty hollow in Iran.
See, that's what I was getting at, is regime change. Is that something that the Iranian public would support? But, you know, getting back to the list of the results of the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran, even Iran's response this week when the new sanctions were imposed said, we have nothing left to sanction. That, the Supreme Leader, Khamenei, being now the sanctions on him personally.
Right.
But the Iran's government said, you know, the United States has been sanctioning us for 40 years. They have nothing left to sanction. How accurate is that?
Yeah, I think that's actually pretty close. I mean, even Secretary of State Pompeo has said we've got about 80% of the Iranian economy actually sanctioned. And there's kind of a dark joke apparently running around Tehran these days that there are three people left who remain unsanctioned, me, my father, and my son. So please let the foreign ministry give our address to President Trump so he can sanction us too. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of truth to that.
Well, that leads into strategies and trying to avoid war. You have written that both sides, both the United States and Iran, have miscalculated. Let's start with the U.S. Why do you see it that the U.S. has miscalculated when dealing with Iran?
Yeah, I think the primary miscalculation is in believing that these stronger sanctions are actually going to bring Iran back to the table. I mean, folks, I think, forget that before the Iran nuclear deal, folks will cite that, hey, the U.S.-led internationally imposed sanctions on the regime actually were part of the reason that brought Iran to the table to negotiate successfully the so-called JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal. But the other piece of that was the U.S. and the P5 plus one allies actually agreed to allow uranium enrichment of uranium. So there was an incentive there too. And I think after a year of the Iranians actually complying with the Iran nuclear deal and seeing effectively no sanctions relief, only getting in return increased sanctions, the incentive for them to return to the table, at least in the near or medium terms, is pretty low. I think that the key thing that would be required is either through private channels or publicly just present something to the Iranians that would be a real concession and that would give them hope that, okay, if we resume, don't break the deal, if we can engage in a larger debate about our other activities in the region, we're willing to do that. But we want to see economic relief now. And of course, the Trump administration is not, at least publicly, inclined to be offering anything of the sort right now.
President Trump campaigned that it was a bad deal, that the deal was something that was one-sided, that the United States got nothing out of it. What about that? How do you see that?
Yeah, I don't see it that way at all. I mean, I kind of fall in line with a lot of the foreign policy consensus on this score. I mean, Iran gave up quite a bit. I mean, it actually reduced its stocks of enriched uranium by some 95%. It reduced the number of centrifuges that were spinning to actually enrich that uranium by two-thirds. And it allowed the most stringent imposition of international regime inspections that's ever been, you know, in arms control history. So there are monitors in the country right now at all the declared production sites. And that's the most effective way, I think, to prevent, you know, a civilian program from bleeding into a nuclear weapons program.
I want to get back to the miscalculation. You said that both sides have miscalculated. What about Iran? What has Iran miscalculated?
Yeah, I think the big miscalculation that Iran is making right now is that, I mean, they're attempting to kind of come to the edge or actually break their agreements with some of the JCPOA limitations. In particular, they're going to exceed this week, arguably, the amount of enriched uranium that they can keep on hand in stock. And they're thinking that that will be increased leverage on Europeans and others to actually give more to ease sanctions. I think that's actually a miscalculation, because I think if Iran continues that kind of behavior, and if they continue the provocative behavior like downing the unmanned U.S. Drone that the U.S., you know, says is in international waters, that will actually rally the Europeans to the U.S. side. And it will make it, it'll just further their international isolation. It won't break it.
Well, see, and then going along, you know, thinking along those lines, I have to wonder, what is Iran thinking? What is their strategy by taking hostile action? Supposedly, I mean, they say that they had nothing to do with the oil tankers that were attacked. We have video that the Trump administration says that here's your proof, and downing of the American drone. Why would Iran do that?
Yeah, I think there are both emotional and rational reasons to do that. I mean, the emotional response, of course, is just, hey, this is just pure retaliation. The U.S. is inflicting an incredible amount of pain on us and our economy, and this is a way to strike back. And a way to strike back in a calculated way that actually prevents a more, a stronger, more forceful U.S. military engagement, right? So they're kind of playing the deniability aspect, but also trying to keep the damage low enough that they can operate below the threshold of a genuine all-out military confrontation. So that's kind of the emotional piece, but there is a rational piece too. I mean, there's an element of from their standpoint, of increasing deterrence. It's sending a signal to the U.S. that, yes, you've got the most powerful military in the world. We're not going to compete with you on a conventional level, but your attacks are not going to be cost-free. So that's another aspect. Another aspect is actually just looking for leverage. I mean, everybody knows that Iran is suffering under sanctions, and no one wants to go into another negotiation from a weak position, right? So this is a way to kind of maybe increase their leverage, anticipating eventually they will go back to negotiations. And again, just show that, that they have cards to play too. It's, they're not coming just with bended knee to another round of negotiations. And then lastly, I think just purely economics. I mean, if they can create some kind of concerns in the international community about oil supply levels, that boosts the price of oil, which it is doing at least to a moderate extent. And so that improves their revenue stream and makes some compensation for their inability to export larger quantities.
It would seem to be a huge gamble, though, when President Trump has, you know, he's talked tough and has shown, I mean, if we go, if the reports were accurate that we were within 10 minutes of a missile strike earlier this week, that I don't know, on Iran's part, it would seem to be a huge gamble that they're getting leverage rather than being attacked.
Right. No, it is a huge gamble. And I think a lot of this is they just feel like they have no other option left, no other arrow in their quiver. I mean, the sanctions are biting incredibly hard. The threat of the U.S. imposing secondary sanctions on European countries and businesses really has everybody incredibly jittery about investing in Iran, and they're just seeing their oil sales and revenues go down. They are concerned about, you know, eventually this causing some political disruption in the country. There's absolutely no doubt that they're concerned about it. And it's also, you know, it's not necessarily a single actor in Iran. I mean, it's not just the supreme leader or president calling the shot. Other actors that are harder line, like the Iranian Islamic Republican Guard Corps, you know, could be pushing this agenda too and looking for a little bit of confrontation. I really don't think they want an all-out military confrontation, but this is where an unintended spark could actually lead to a much larger confrontation.
When you say that you don't think they want an all-out confrontation or all-out war, we have heard in this country that Secretary Bolton, for example, or John Bolton, a national security advisor, that, you know, he has been a hawk on Iran for years. And we've also heard that there are some factions in Iran that may want war. What do you think? I mean, are there people who actually would like to, I don't know whether you can say like to see, but wouldn't be upset if there would be a military confrontation?
Yeah, there are definitely elements on both sides, you know, both in Washington and in Tehran, who are pushing for a much harder line confrontation. Of course, they both feel justified, right? And they think that's the right approach going forward. I mean, the Iranian public has been through A lot, though. I mean, folks may not remember, but I mean, the Iran-Iraq War for them was really the first Gulf War, right? I mean, that was 1980 to 1988. Millions of lives were lost. Missiles were exchanged. There was a tanker war as well during that time when international oil was disrupted. So the potential for something like that ought to scare elements on both sides, and I think, you know, does introduce an element of caution on both sides as well.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. You can see some of the shows we're working on for the future here on WITF Smart Talk, including some shows that we talk about new tools to address suicide in Pennsylvania, kickoff of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, and a Democratic presidential candidate. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about the United States and Iran. A lot of tension over the last few weeks. Our guest, Dr. Christopher Bolin, a senior fellow in the Middle East program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's a professor of Middle East Security Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. And you can read some of the columns that Dr. Bolin has written on our website, WITF.org, about the U.S. and Iran. Our phone number, if you'd like to weigh in on what you think about the United States and Iran, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I just want to pick up on something you mentioned a little bit earlier about gas prices, that they have gone up, but probably not as much as what many people would have thought. And I don't know, it just seems as though in the past, whenever there's been any kind of danger, or potential danger for tankers going through the Strait of Hormuz, the gas prices right away went up. Why haven't they done that this time?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that's an interesting observation. I think there are a number of reasons for it. I mean, one is because the oil energy market really is quite a bit different now than it has been. A lot of that is because of the U.S. now itself is the major producer of energy in the world now. So that's really upended global markets as well. There's actually a decrease in global demand that is kind of keeping, you know, prices down because there's adequate supply, there's less demand. There's also been increased production not only by the U.S., but by allies like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and President Trump actually, in advance of the sanctions, trumpeted this. You know, I mean, he said, look, we've got allies who are going to really increase their production and help make up for the lack of Iranian oil exports. Also, since the 1973 oil embargo, there's been something created among the U.S. and its allies, both in Asia and in Europe as well. It's called the Strategic Petroleum Oil Reserve. And so each country actually maintains a reserve precisely to compensate for any disruption in the oil market. And that's actually been built up over the decades to be quite substantial. Some recent estimates I've read suggest that even if the Hormuz Strait were totally closed, which is highly unlikely, highly improbable, that those reserves could actually compensate for 8 months. So all these things, I think, are kind of keeping the market nervousness down to a manageable level.
Does Iran have less leverage then? And I guess the second part of that question, if the answer is yes, does that mean they act more, I don't know, with more hostility if they have less leverage with their oil?
Yeah, I think that's exactly, I think, unfortunately, that's exactly right. I mean, if you're taking a look at long-term global trends for all those reasons I laid out, any exporter of oil is actually going to be in a more difficult position going forward. I mean, that's why you see in the region a lot of economic reform proposals. I mean, Saudi Arabia in particular has its Vision 2030, which really lays out a plan for decreasing their dependence on oil exports alone, diversifying their economy. And you see those kind of plans proliferating throughout the region because they know oil is not their future. They've got to develop alternatives. So all the countries, oil exporting anyway, are really facing that problem, and Iran is certainly one of them.
We have an email from Rich. It says, over the past month or so, I've heard maybe hundreds of discussions on Iran and U.S. history. Seems to me the press, not just the right-wing press like Fox, but middle of the road like NPR and even left-wing like MSNBC, are all right-wing on this subject. I guess what Rich is saying, or if I can kind of add to it, is that he's thinking that this is something that the media is, I don't know if promoting is the right word, but that the reporting between the United States on the United States and Iran, or that that taking kind of a hardline stance on the American side. What do you think?
Yeah, but I do think, I mean, I think the media is actually accurately covering this. I mean, there is a real risk of even an unintended spark igniting a much larger regional confrontation. The U.S. and Iran and Iranian forces and their proxy forces are actually locating in very close proximity to one another. It's true in the Gulf. It's true in Syria. It's true in Iraq. It's true in Yemen. So any incident there between Iranian forces or U.S. forces holds a potential for leading to a greater escalation. So I think the media coverage on that is actually well-deserved.
One of the things, and you kind of touched on this earlier, but you say that one of the miscalculations, if you will, of the Trump administration is that the Trump administration has not given Iran a clear path, has not let Iran know what they need to do, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and to getting back to the negotiating table, or at least diffuse the situation somewhat.
You know, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's their goals are just overly lofty and unrealistic, I think. I mean, Secretary Pompeo in May of 2018 actually laid out 12 specific demands for Iran if they want to come back to the negotiating table. But those demands from the Iranian standpoint are really just not going to happen. I mean, one, for instance, just take a few for example. I mean, one is to actually end uranium enrichment. Well, Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the program in Iran was actually started under President Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace initiative. So from the Iranian standpoint, they're a signatory to the NPT. They're entitled to peaceful enrichment of uranium. So walking that back is going to be incredibly hard. Similarly, with demanding a total Iranian withdrawal from Syria, certainly Israel would like to see it. The U.S. would like to see it, but it's wholly unrealistic in my personal view. Syria has been Iran's only state ally in the region ever since the revolution in 1979, so they're not going to easily give up that kind of lone reed of support. So I think the key thing is really, rather than a list of 12 overreaching demands, really be clear about specifically what demands the U.S. has and give the Iranians a sense of priorities, right? So we can get something positive started. So here's what we would like you to do that's eminently achievable, definitely at some, sacrifice on your part, but here's the specific reward we're going to tie for that. And something like that, some kind of small confidence building measures, I think are really necessary to reverse this deteriorating situation.
I saw that list of 12 demands that Secretary Pompeo outlined May of 2018. Most of them do seem fairly reasonable when you're going into a negotiation. But just yesterday, President Trump said two things for Iran: abandon your nuclear program and stop sponsoring terrorism. Now, the language would be a little more lofty than that when you go into a negotiation, but those two seem to be at least a good starting point from the American point of view.
Right. And of course, the Iranians will say, we've stopped our nuclear weapons program. That was actually verified in a 2007 U.S. intelligence estimate that said Iranian nuclear weapons program and development had actually stopped in 2003. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, that's doing the inspections inside Iran, has consistently verified that Iran is complying with all the aspects of the JCPOA that are deliberately targeted and intended to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapons program. So they will say, we were already doing that. We've got international sanction that verifies we're doing that. And yet we did not get any rewards promised, which was the sanctions relief. And similar with terrorism, you do get, unfortunately, into this little bit of who's a terrorist, is a terrorist a freedom fighter or not. And, you know, they will argue that Hezbollah maybe has terrorist military elements, and the U.S. has designated Hezbollah in Lebanon, now fighting as well in Syria, as a foreign terrorist organization, an FTO. But they will, you know, also say, well, but it also has a political wing, it has an economic wing, it has a social wing, it actually has formal representation in the Lebanese government. So, you know, we're not going to end in total our relationship with Hezbollah.
Along those same lines, you've written that it is a myth that Iran is the biggest, that they destabilize the Middle East more than anyone else. Why is that a myth?
Yeah, well, that's maybe a little bit hyperbole. I mean, I think in terms of a narrow military sense, I mean, Iran has definitely taken actions that are destabilizing the region, right? But they're taking advantage of the chaos, uncertainty, and instability that's already there. And I think from looking at the region over a long period of time that really the basic sources of instability are what we saw in the Arab Spring. I mean, when we saw the Arab Spring just spread throughout the region, it was protest against local Arab leaders, right? Authoritarian leaders who had just failed to deliver economic prosperity, who were authoritarian and repressive. And these were people just demanding their basic human rights from their own leaders. Iran was certainly not behind those uprisings. And one of the very positive aspects, I think, of those uprisings from a U.S. standpoint, that you did not see U.S. flags being burned in the streets, right? This was something that was really domestically inspired and focused. And I think that if there's any, you know, positive hope for the region, it's that those kind of demands will actually lead to genuine reform and liberalization in the region.
Rich, just wanted to follow up what Richard said. He said that I just proved his point. The U.S. Navy shot down an Iranian airliner with 290 people aboard. Mentioned that. Of course, I will. We just mentioned it, but it also happened 30 years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, I do think that demonstrates, I mean, there are two different views that you see on the Iranian government and the nature of the Iranian government. One is that it's inherently revolutionary and theocratically based. The other is that it's a rational actor. And I mean, I think the fact that, you know, what was the Iranian response to the U.S. shoot down of that airliner in the 1980s? I mean, over 200 Iranian civilians were killed as a result of the, you know, U.S. Navy attack on that plane, mistaking it for an attacking military aircraft. And the Iranians' response was very muted, right? So, I mean, I think that just demonstrates that in large measure, the Iranian government is acting from their vantage point in a rational fashion.
The last week or so, especially since the drone was shot down, there's been a lot of tough talk on both sides. Iran said earlier this week that it would never accept diplomatic terms. Now, we know that a lot of times things change and can change pretty quickly, but they seem to have been, I don't know, just again, an observation that Iran's government and supreme leader especially has really gotten more angry over this last round of sanctions than anything else and the tough talk from President Trump. I mean, calling him mentally unstable and the words to that effect. It kind of goes back to what you heard 2 years ago between the Trump administration and North Korea, mm-hmm. and the president and North Korean leader have met twice since, may meet another time over the next week or so. So when Iran says we will never sit down at the table again, will they?
Yeah, of course. I mean, absolutely they will. I mean, ultimately, this gets back to whether you're a rational actor or not. But I mean, ultimately, the way out of this, the most optimistic way out of this and hopeful way out of this is renegotiation. And there was a similar development during the Iran-Iraq War. The supreme leader at the time Khomeini actually said similar thing. He said, look, I'm never going to negotiate with Iraq after Iraq invaded Iran in 1980. And yet he agreed to do that. And he said, yes, I'm drinking this poison chalice, you know, on behalf of the Iranian people. So I think that can and hopefully, you know, will change.
You also have written that you think that the United States has lost credibility. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think they've lost credibility, certain in a lot of the, from the Iranian standpoint, right? I mean, one of the things the U.S. Walking away from the international agreement that was negotiated, one of the things it signals is that the U.S. is not a reliable partner. They committed to this negotiation, and then there was a change in administration in the country. Walked it back, so they can't be trusted. And that explains part of why things are getting so personal with this tension now with Iran. The Supreme Leader really was arguing from the get-go that the U.S. can't be trusted, we shouldn't get engaged in these negotiations. And he was really only convinced by the President Rouhani, who was elected on a platform of re-engaging with the West to alleviate the economic situation, that, you know, and so Rouhani and the folks who supported the negotiation were discredited. And the hardliners say, look, we told you so, the U.S. can never be treated, you know, can never be trusted again. And so the Supreme Leader felt a little bit, I suspect, felt really personally damaged by that. His reputation was damaged. So he's lashing out in a personal way. But ultimately, he is the leader of a nation. And I think, again, if the U.S. or others were able to actually offer something very concrete and substantial, he would probably recalculate and reengage in negotiations.
Let's take a phone call from John in Harrisburg. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Great show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was just thinking that the Trump administration, I think their plan is to eradicate anybody that is sponsoring terrorism. So I see that he sees Iran as they're getting involved. Iran's involved in other countries trying to spread terrorism. So I think that's what he's coming from. And the leaders of Iran, they're the problem. I remember under the Obama administration, the people of Iran were protesting. It kind of broke my heart. They were holding up signs in English saying, hey, America, help us get rid of these guys. So I felt really bad that we didn't do anything about that under the Obama administration. And I'm not worried about hurting the leaders of Iran's feelings. They're constantly up to no good. So I just wanted to know your guest's opinion. Thank you, Scott.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, Iran has definitely undertaken, as I've said, I mean, they're undertaking what the, you know, U.S. officials rightly refer to as a number of malign activities in the region, right? There's no, I'm not saying that U.S. interest and Iranian interest actually coincide. I think there's some overlap that might be reached, but definitely, I mean, the Iranian foreign policy objective is to oust the United States from the region to increase their own freedom of maneuver. But that also doesn't mean that we can't cooperate and shouldn't cooperate in areas where it's mutually beneficial. I would argue that limiting Iran's civilian nuclear program with an admittedly imperfect agreement, every agreement is imperfect, is better than just allowing them to move forward willy-nilly. I mean, one of the things President Obama, you know, I think rightly said was, look, if you think Iran is a problem in the region without nuclear weapons, just imagine what a problem it would be if Iran did have a nuclear weapons capability. So I'm not being Pollyannish at all about the Iranian leadership or its ultimate objectives. I'm just saying nations being nations can and where they, you know, can, should find common ground that serves mutual interest. I mean, one small example of that was the fight against ISIS in Iraq. I mean, it was the Iranian-supported and backed Shia militia in Iraq that played a key part in ousting ISIS from Iraq. And, you know, that, why should we not encourage that when it serves everyone's interest?
Dr. Bolin, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. So what happens next?
Well, I think in the military, we kind of divvy things up in three different scenarios, right? I think the most optimistic but least likely scenario is renegotiations in the near term. As you've kind of mentioned, we've talked about, I think that's not really likely for a lot of reasons, at least in the near term. It's going to take a major change on both sides to turn that around. A military conflict is possible, even though folks don't want it. You know, leaders have both publicly expressed that neither wants to go to war, but they're actually both willing to do so if they need to defend what they view as their own national interest. That's also the most dangerous course of action, because as Iran has demonstrated, they do have, you know, levers to play, and they do have a missile capability that could certainly target oil production facilities.
Or Israel.
Or Israel, but I think more likely, I mean, with the targeting of Israel, you also have to remember, I mean, everything's in very close proximity, and there is Jerusalem, which is the third holiest, you know, site in Islam. So that has its own downsides. But I think more likely they would probably target the oil production facilities in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, UAE, anyone who they viewed as participating in any coalition attack on Iran. So that's the most dangerous. The most likely, and I think most cost-effective, would actually be just containment. I mean, we are where we are. So the U.S. can actually do what it can to rally regional allies and supporters to just limit the influence that Iran has in the region. And I think that's probably the most likely, at least in the near term.
Dr. Christopher Boland, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Boland is professor of Middle East Security Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Thank you for your insights.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Listen, tomorrow we'll be talking about eating disorders. And amongst our guests tomorrow, Joey Julius, who was the former kicker at Penn State, became kind of a folk hero when he was at Penn State. He'll be on the program tomorrow as we discuss eating disorders along with several other guests. You can visit our website, get an outlook of conversations we're working on, plus leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.com. .org/smarttalk. The largest oil refinery on the East Coast in South Philadelphia was heavily damaged by explosions and fire last Friday morning. Repercussions from the incident continue to be felt this week as the facility's owner, Philadelphia Energy Solutions, said yesterday it is shutting down the refinery and laying 1,000 workers off. The investigation into the fire could last for more than a year. Joining us with more information on this fire and the repercussions, State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Susan Phillips. Susan Phillips, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott.
Beyond Philadelphia and the Philadelphia area, Susan, why is this fire and the refinery shutdown significant?
Well, like you said, this is the largest refinery on the East Coast. It may be the oldest in the country. It was, you know, part of it was built around the time of the Civil War. And it provides about 27% of the fuel consumed on the East Coast. So having it shut down is not insignificant at all. That said, you know, I think when I've talked to analysts about this, there are other supply chains that will be able to feed the East Coast gasoline. So, you know, there's not going to be long lines at the pump or sharp spikes in gasoline prices. But people, especially in July, which is the month of the highest demand on gasoline, people may see some increases in gasoline.
You know, that brings up a point when you say that supplied 27% of the gasoline in, did you say in the country or on the East Coast?
No, on the East Coast.
On the East Coast. But yet it was reported that they were losing money. How?
Yeah. Well, you know, a number of things. When this is a refinery that has struggled financially for decades, and it, you know, it had been in bankruptcy, and it was sort of brought back from the brink of destruction back in 2012, if you remember. That's when the Carlyle Group purchased the plant, and really the plant itself is actually two different refineries. And the one thing that had revived it back then, and I don't know if, you know, people remember or still see these black tankers, black rail tankers that carry crude oil from North Dakota all the way across the country to Philadelphia, they were carrying Bakken crude oil. It was cheap, so they were able to sort of, you know, revive the refinery with this new source of crude oil in North Dakota. But since that's happened, a lot of pipelines have been built. We know that there were battles over these pipelines, but nevertheless, they're in the ground. They were built, and they're taking the crude oil to the Gulf Coast. So there's not as cheap a supply. I mean, the crude oil from North Dakota still comes across the country to this plant, but it's not as cheap. And then the other thing is the renewable fuel standards, and that's sort of complicated, but they really did take a hit with renewable fuel standards, which basically forces refineries to blend ethanol. And if you're not a refinery that can blend ethanol, and this is not a refinery that did its own ethanol blending, you have to then buy credits, right, on the open market. And those credits, for a number of reasons, have skyrocketed in price, and that's also forced this refinery operation to take a hit.
As you reported, it's not expected that gas prices will increase. Initially, right after the fire on Friday, on Saturday when the fire was put out, I saw some initial reports saying that they thought there would be an increase in gas prices. But since then, it's been reported, in fact, you reported, that not much, maybe a penny or two. Why is that? Because, you know, thinking back historically, when there would be a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, and a refinery would be shut down, prices right. would go up almost automatically. Why not in this case?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, what happens when there's like a hurricane is like all of a sudden, boom, there's a number of different refineries that are shut down in the Gulf Coast. And those supply together a lot more oil and gas. But in this case, you know, there are other refineries on the East Coast, especially in the Philadelphia region. I mean, there's Delaware City Refinery, PBF. I mean, there's a refinery in Lindenwald, New Jersey. I mean, there are other refineries that are still supplying gasoline. And unlike a hurricane that shuts down sort of a whole region's worth of refineries, this is not doing that.
Mm. So, Susan, just so we can maybe I'll back up for just a moment. What actually happened Friday? Do we know what caused the explosions and the fire?
So we don't know what caused the explosion yet, or at least they haven't reported what's caused the explosion yet. What we do know was that there was a leak of liquefied petroleum gas, and that could include a mixture of things like propane and butane. And people probably know these things because that's home heating oil. That's sort of what you use in your gas grill, in your backyard. Basically, there was a leak and a large container exploded. So there was, you know, a big fireball in the air, and it was caught on film. And people in the neighborhood, you know, woke up at around 4 in the morning. Their houses shook. They heard like 3 successive large booms. And then, of course, you know, a fire ensued, and it was so hot that it was detected from space, from satellites out in space.
Wow. The impact on the area surrounding the facility?
So there was a lot of air monitoring going on. There were a lot of fears because you got to understand this is on a regular day without a fire. This refinery is, you know, the largest single source of air pollution in the city. And the neighbors around that refinery have always complained, have been complaining for years of weird smells, of odors, of things that give them headaches or maybe exacerbate their asthma. But what the health officials are saying is that the fire itself didn't cause it didn't cause significant air pollution to the surrounding neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And I think one of the reasons why, when I was down there that day, you know, the wind was so strong. I mean, it was a lot of wind. So it may have blown whatever pollutants were being released into the air downwind, or it may have dispersed it a lot, but it did not, you know, the monitoring did not show any significant air pollution. And they also, you know, sort of take a look at emergency room visits, and they didn't see a spike in emergency room visits from that area either.
Philadelphia Energy Solutions says that it will close the facility and 1,000 people will be losing their jobs. Why are they closing?
Well, I mean, they basically said that, you know, they've been struggling financially for years, and this fire sort of put them over the edge. They didn't have the finances. What they're saying is they didn't have the finances to repair that part of the plant. Now, what the union will tell you, and I spoke to the union president that morning, and he was pretty upset, obviously, and upset that they weren't told before the Reuters report reported the closure. But, you know, what he was saying was, look, you know, they have a lot of insurance on that facility, and he felt like the workers themselves were betrayed by the company, and that the company is just going to take the insurance and run. Now, where the truth is, I really don't know. But the long and the short of it is, a lot of people have been saying that this is a struggling refinery and would shut down within a couple of years. And it looks like this fire just sort of put it over the edge.
We can assume that those were good-paying jobs. Obviously, the workers and their families are going to be impacted. What about the local economy?
Yes, the local economy is going to take a huge hit. You know, it as you said, there's about 1,000 jobs. Not sure who or how many people are getting laid off right away. Obviously, some people have to stick around for, you know, the cleaning up and the inspection, all the sort of investigations that are going on around this fire. But, you know, there's always, in a situation like this, when you have such a heavy concentration of good-paying jobs in a region, for people to be suddenly out of those jobs, it has, you know, repercussions beyond just those people who have lost their jobs.
As you mentioned, and I'll put it another way, not everyone was sad to hear the news of the facility closing. Environmental groups, as you described earlier, said that this facility was a polluter, had a bad environmental track record. What are they saying about this?
So, I think the neighbors had been also calling for it to be shut down. But what they're saying is, you know, they're saying, well, that's a good thing for air quality in the city, and they'd like to see the refinery reshaped as a renewable energy facility, potentially. I mean, there's a lot of ideas being floated out there about what to do with this facility, but I think it's important to keep in mind the legacy of pollution here, which really limits what you could do with a site like that. And it's a huge site, Scott. I mean, it's 1,300 acres. And we're talking about environmental pollution that was occurring even before there was the EPA or any kind of environmental regulations. So you've got, you know, polluted soil. You've probably got, you know, a lot of damaged groundwater over there. So, not to mention what the fire may have done to exacerbate that. So it's a discussion, I think, that will be ongoing, and it'll be interesting to see. Now, the company also said that they're, you know, going to try to sell the plant to another operator, perhaps. I mean, that's, you know, we'll wait and see whether that is feasible or not.
State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Susan Phillips. Thank you very much, Susan, for the update and providing some context here to Central Pennsylvania as to why this was such a significant event. Thanks, Susan.
You're welcome.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WITF, WHYY, WESA, and the Allegheny Front to cover the state's energy economy. I want to move on. I'll tell you about something going on tonight. Here's a quote. If I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. That's how Sue Klebold describes her shock at her son's involvement in the massacre that occurred at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. In more than 20 years since the tragedy, Sue Klebold has learned more about her son's inner turmoil and now shares her findings with other parents. She hopes it will lead others to dig deeper into the lives of their children. On Transforming Health, Mental Health, and Schools, Sue Klebold will share her memories of the tragedy at Columbine. You can hear that tonight. School officials, others talk about efforts to normalize conversations about mental health. It is tonight at 8 on WITF-TV, Transforming Health, so be sure to tune in. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about eating disorders on WITF Smart Talk.